From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. From the Flintstones to Geico commercials, we know what it means to be cavemen, right? Grunting, stone tools, and dragging your woman by her hair to your cave. Well, last week, all of that changed. A study of DNA extracted from Neanderthal bones more than 35,000 years old revealed an amazing truth. We are today 1-4% Neanderthal. And keep in mind, only a few weeks ago, just about everyone thought we were not related to Neanderthals, and in fact, the argument went, it was anatomically impossible for early humans and Neanderthals to even breed. Well, not anymore. Steve Paulson spoke with paleoanthropologist John Hawks about the significance of this new finding.
How important is this finding that we are related to Neanderthals?
Well, you know, from my point of view, this is the most exciting thing that has really happened in my career. We have the fossil remains, their bones, of something like 200 or maybe a few more Neanderthal individuals. And when I say bones, they're broken up into little bits, most of them. We really only have a handful of skeletons where there's more than just a couple of bones. And this genome gives us something like 100 times as much information as that number of bones. I mean, it's amazing. And to be able to make that connection between us and them and show that we still have their genes now, this is not an ancient group of people that, you know, became extinct. We now know that they're part of our heritage. And it totally revises the way that we have thought about the interactions of people in the past and how our traits emerged as a species.
What does it change about our own history?
Well, one of the things that has been a real mystery is, why is it that these hominids that lived outside of Africa, why did they decline? And how is it that modern humans have come to have such a high fraction of genes that were in Africans at that time? We could see the Neanderthals. We have their stones that they made and other kinds of evidence about their behaviors. We could see that they were complicated. You know, they were doing interesting things.
That they had religious burials. They used lots of technology, stone tools, that kind of thing.
Over the past couple of years, we've discovered that they were using little rocks that were pigment rocks, manganese dioxide, that they were using to paint soft objects, which means either their skin or hides that they might have been wearing. And they had a real artistic side. And we find a few artifacts that reflect that. That's stuff that when we see it in modern people, we think, well, that's what makes us modern. And yet this other group of people had it. And now, of course, we know that it emerged in them and in us as some sort of continuity that really reframes the way that we thought about the emergence of humanity.
So you're saying this partly revises our notion of what it means to be human, and it also elevates the status of Neanderthals.
Oh, yeah. It extends it. It says that the traits that make us human have been emerging over hundreds of thousands of years in a dispersed population. And another aspect from this study that is really important is, by comparing the Neanderthal genome with ours, they were able to find points where the human genome has changed a lot since our divergence from Neanderthals. And it turns out that there are only 212 of those by their estimate. So that means that the stuff that makes us modern is really a very limited number of things. And hopefully we'll be able to put some order to it. You know, what things happened when and what were their effects.
So this really is a remarkable finding. How did these scientists do this? How did they figure out that we are related to Neanderthals?
Well, the first step is sequencing the DNA. And in these fossil bones, the DNA is broken up into very tiny fragments. Up until 5 or 10 years ago, I used to give lectures about how this would never happen. But it turns out that the next generation sequencing technologies that today they're using to turn out human genomes, the way that they work is by sequencing short fragments of DNA and stitching them together automatically with the computer. It's once you have that knowledge of the human genome and chimpanzee genomes and other primates and other kinds of organisms that the computers can do this reconstruction. And so what they were able to do was reconstruct the sequence. And then they compared it to human variation today. And what they found was that the Neanderthal is substantially more similar to people who live outside of Africa than inside. And that signature wouldn't be there if the Neanderthals hadn't contributed genes to people who live in today the places that they used to live.
Do we know where this was when there was interbreeding between our human ancestors and Neanderthals?
Well, the comparison shows that humans that today live in France, who live in China, who live in Papua New Guinea, you know, basically all over Eurasia and Southeast Asia, those populations seem to carry a similar proportion of Neanderthal genes. And what that has to mean, we think, is that as humans were emerging from Africa, they mixed immediately with the populations of hominids that lived outside of Africa, probably in the Near East. What's interesting is that we know that Neanderthal populations were living there between 100,000 and about 50,000 years ago. So this gives us a real candidate for where and when this mixing took place.
So there was a separate population of Neanderthals that made its way out of Africa to some of these other areas, Europe and Asia. And then there were also these early hominids who made their own way out. And then later on, they met and exchanged genetic material.
That's what it looks like now. Now, my lab here will be reevaluating and trying to test other models to really get a lot of confidence in this. Another thing that we're real interested in is, did we get anything from the Neanderthals that was useful, that conferred some advantage? Because if we did, those things might have spread even more. So we're especially interested in issues of diet because they ate different things than us. We're really interested in issues of disease because a question is, why is the fraction of this mixture only something like 1 or 2 or 4%? Why isn't it 10% or more? You know, what is it that kept that proportion down?
So clearly they were distinct populations. I guess we can't say distinct species anymore.
I've been answering this question a lot, because unless we want to envision some humans today as interspecific hybrids, we really have to redefine. You know, the human species includes these ancient people who lived in many different parts of the world.
I would think that this just must be exciting for a scientist to see something like this. I mean, the whole conventional way of thinking about Neanderthal history has just flown out the window.
You know, it's shocking in a way. I have been a Neanderthal consistently. You know, I was always, I don't think that they're gone. I think they contributed something. I see some signs of their traits persisting into later populations. And to have suddenly this be the conventional wisdom, to me, it's like, wow, you know, it's amazing. And at the same time, I understand that now when I talk to people about Neanderthals, I can tell them these are part of your heritage. And that gives us a totally new view on humanity and its borders and what it's today, what its variation means. I mean, to think of the way that anthropology impacts people and the way they view each other, we talk about human variation a lot. But to understand that there's a group of people that doesn't exist anymore that we have to encompass into our family, and what does that mean for our similarities today, which are immense compared to what's gone in the past? You know, I just think it's a wonderful day for all of us.
Well, and you've suggested that this is such a radical new way of seeing things. It's kind of like those first photos from outer space, from the Apollo missions, looking back to planet Earth. I mean, people had never seen what Earth looked like before.
Yeah, that's really my favorite analogy. It's not like the moon landing. We can't build a Neanderthal, and we still have so much to learn. But just gives us that snapshot of here we are today, and here's where some of us were 40,000 years ago. And soon we'll have pictures from other places. We're really exploring a prehistory that has been beneath the surface that we haven't been able to see.
John Hawks is a professor of biological anthropology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. He specializes in the study of genetics of ancient humans. Steve Paulson spoke with him. What do you think about being related to Neanderthals? You can send us an email at ttbook.org or go to our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. Now, we may be 1 to 4% Neanderthal, but anthropologist Brian Fagan says the rest of us is something else. Cro-Magnon. He argues in his book titled Cro-Magnon, How the Ice Age Gave Birth to the First Modern Humans, that they were just like us, anatomically modern humans, and how they survived the Ice Age made us who we are today.
The Cro-Magnons were identical to us. They had all the full modern cognitive abilities we have, the abilities to plan and innovate and so on. They were also technologically very ingenious. And the thing that really stands out about them is that the dynamics of their lives, which involved obviously constant movement, following game, following the season, the short seasons of plants, foods, and so on, made them extremely versatile. And they, unlike the Neanderthals, who seem to have hunted mainly larger animals like bison and wild oxen, the Cro-Magnons hunted everything. And they had the specialized weaponry for doing it, which was far more sophisticated than anything the Neanderthals had.
And that's where you come down to this business of the Cro-Magnon being essentially us. It is the same kind of ability to adapt that we expect of modern man that made it possible for the Cro-Magnon to survive?
Yes, and there is one terribly fundamental difference between the Neanderthals and Cro-Magnons, which is one we share ourselves. They had an extremely close and vivid relationship with the symbolic of our world around them, the supernatural world, which is reflected in their cave paintings. And this supernatural relationship with the spiritual world was very important because they believed that, like modern hunter-gatherers, that the supernatural world and the living world they lived in were really the same, and you passed from one to the other. And their imaginations, their artistry, everything was completely different to anything the Neanderthals ever had.
This is where the art that we've discovered comes in. Their ability to develop needles so that they could create tailored clothing is similar, I suppose, to their understanding of works of art, of carving, of painting, of colors. And their connection with the other world in the paintings of the hunts is both spiritual and artistic.
It's very interesting. I would suspect there's a huge discussions over this. The art had a purpose. There were people among them who clearly were very expert artists. You have to look at the Grotte de Chauvet or at Altamira or Lascaux, the famous caves, to see the extraordinary ability of these people to paint animals. And in fact, there have been studies, for example, of reindeer, which have been painted on cave walls, where they even think they can identify the season of the year because of the way the coat of the reindeer has been painted. There were expert artists, but the main purpose of this art was symbolic and supernatural. And I was terribly lucky when I was young to go into some of the cave paintings and engravings, to see some of them at the light of a flickering candle and an acetylene lamp. And as the lamp flickers, you literally can see the animals moving. And the people who conducted ceremonies there clearly had a flair for performance and what you might call live theater. And all of this revolved around transmitting information from one generation to the next, around success in the hunt, and all kinds of things which we can't possibly, at this chronological range, reconstruct.
But there is a sense, and you come back to it again and again, that these people are the same as people are now. You, at one point in the book, offer up, I believe it was someone else's construction, but your writing of it is telling of a banquet, a proposed imaginary banquet with Cro-Magnon sitting at one end and a Nobel Prize laureate at the other. And there is the sense that with a little help from the intervening generations, they could actually talk to each other.
We are they. They lived in an unimaginably different world to ours. Their way of looking at it is totally different to anything we would conceive it of. But ultimately, if we met, we would look at each other. And having myself encountered people who'd never seen a white person before in Africa, you realize you communicate not with language, but with gestures and feelings. And after a while, you realize that you are humans, even if the world you live in day to day is totally different.
Coming back to this world of the Ice Age, we do, in the same way that we have stereotypes of the Neanderthal, we have stereotypes of the environment at the time. Were there seasons in the year? Did the world they lived in resemble ours in any other way?
Oh, yeah, they had seasons. The seasons were different. I mean, there was no absolutely precise analog for late Ice Age climate on Europe, on Earth now. It was a climate of extremes. You would have had 8 to 9 month winters with sub-zero temperatures for weeks on end, maybe months. You would have had, in Europe, a pretty dry environment. Rainfall was not that common. A lot of very strong winds off the ice sheets, which were bitterly cold. Short, probably quite warm summers. I mean, temperate, 50s, 60s, maybe even higher summers, where there was a very brief growing season, a short spring and autumn, and the fall would have found frosts starting probably in early September. But the critical event seasonally for these people were two things. One were the spring and fall migrations of reindeer moving to new pastures, and the other one would have been salmon runs, which in around 15,000 years ago assumed considerable importance. And in that sense, they were like Alaska.
So from a modern perspective, what is to be gained from studying the Cro-Magnon, and for that matter, the Neanderthal? What can they teach us about living in the world at their time of climate change that we may need to know in ours?
It's a very interesting question, because a lot of people think, oh, the world of 15 to 18,000 years ago is totally irrelevant to our lives. In a major sense, it is. We live in a highly cosseted industrial society. But one of the things about living in a very globalized society is that we need a much more thorough understanding of human, cultural, and biological diversity than you can acquire by reading books or anything. And one of the great things about Cro-Magnons is we know a great deal about them. And our knowledge of them is illuminated also by studies of historic Inuit and Eskimo people in the 19th and 20th century. And from this, we can look at human diversity and say, 15,000 years ago, we coped with climate change by being very adaptable, by moving, by supporting each other, and by being very much in tune with the environment, which is something we forget. And I think we've got a great deal of subtle information about human existence, and about human diversity we can learn from these remote forebears.
No, I'm tempted to ask you, because there was an ice age that they lived through, if, as you say, the ice age gave birth to the first modern humans, should we face one again, would it do the same for us?
No, I don't think it would. I think we now are in a world where there are all kinds of variables which affect human evolution, and I don't think it would, no.
You know, it's interesting to hear you say that you think that in that sense our world is different from theirs, that there are too many things going on now, perhaps over which we have no control, for us to be able to adapt in the same way that they did. Is it simply that there are too many of us in too many places and we've done too much to the Earth?
It's a whole combination of things. We've done too much to the Earth. There are far too many of us. We are now short of resources like water. We are living in heavily urbanized environments where, unlike Cro-Magnon, who could move away from, say, exceptionally cold weather or from a place where there was no game and water, we can't move. Look at the experience of Hurricane Katrina and the other hurricane, the difficulty of evacuating people. We are in a world that's totally different, highly industrialized, instant communication, and the chances of form of biological evolution happening, I think, are pretty small.
Much of what we know, everything, frankly, that we know about the Cro-Magnon, we know from sites that have been discovered, from burial mounds. We've discovered costumes that they wore and the materials that they developed in order to survive. And yet, of course, we've never been able to find any written record because there wasn't any other than the paintings. We have no way of speaking to them. If you could, what question would you most want to ask?
That's a fascinating question. I think I would want to hear a shaman or an elder recite the vision they had of the world they lived in. How did they put it together? Was it a world of layers? Did it have an afterworld? Were there powerful supernatural forces that governed their existence? How did their relationship with animals affect the way they lived on a day-to-day basis? This, to me, the intangibles would be what I would love to know. What made these people tick?
Brian Fagan's the author of Cro-Magnon, How the Ice Age Gave Birth to the First Modern Humans. Later this hour, one young adult fiction writer talks about why her Chronicles of Ancient Darkness novels are set in the Stone Age.
I've kind of created, I hope, a sort of legend for the Stone Age people. But what stories did they tell? Because, of course, for them, the world was old.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
For a moment, the strange wolf stopped. Then it moved forwards again. The cub couldn't see it very clearly because his eyes weren't nearly as sharp as his nose and ears, but as it splashed across the fast wet, he made out that this was a very strange wolf indeed. It walked on its hind legs.
Sir Ian McKellen, reading from the young adult novel Wolf Brother.
The fur on its head was black, and so long that it reached right down to its shoulders, and strangest of all, it had no tail. Suddenly the strange wolf took another gulp and jerked its great claw away from the cub's belly. Then it sat down heavily in the mud and clutched the cub to its chest. The cub's terror vanished. Through the strange, furless hide that smelt more of not wolf than wolf, he could hear a comforting thump, thump, like the sound he heard when he clambered on top of his father for a nap. The cub wriggled out of the strange wolf's grip, put his forepaws on its chest, and stood on his hind legs. He began to lick the strange wolf's muzzle. Angrily, the strange wolf pushed him away, and he fell backwards. Undeterred, he righted himself and sat gazing up at the strange wolf. Such an odd, flat, furless face. The lips weren't black like a proper wolf's, but pale. And the ears were pale too, and they didn't move at all. But the eyes were silver-grey and full of light, the eyes of a wolf. The cub felt better than he had since the fast wet had come. He'd found a new pack brother.
Ian McKellen, reading from the novel Wolf Brother. It's part of the Chronicles of Ancient Darkness series by Michelle Paver. The books are set 6,000 years ago and follow the adventures of 12-year-old Torak and his wolf companion as they battle great evil to save the world. Paver not only studied archaeology and anthropology to write these books, she actually lived with the Inuit of Alaska and the Sami of Lapland to try to understand her characters better. Anne Strainchamps asked Michelle Paver where her interest, her obsession with the Stone Age, comes from.
It goes back to before I could read. My parents had a great big book of beautiful, very accurate illustrations of life in the Stone Age, which I still have. And I used to lie on my tummy in the sitting room and just look at these. And I wanted to do that. And when I grew a little older, when I was 10, I wanted to live like the Stone Age people. So I got rid of my bed and slept on the floor, and I saved up my pocket money, and I bought a rabbit, a dead rabbit from the butcher's. I took it to the garage and I skinned it because I wanted to make clothes. Of course, it was a little bunny, so it wasn't big enough. But my parents were brilliant. They let me do this sort of thing. I wanted a wolf as well. There, they said, they drew the line. I mean, perhaps because I lived in Wimbledon, as I still do, South London. So, you know. But that, I think, it's the childhood idea of, you know, building your own shelter and making your clothes out of animals and I suppose not going to school, that had a large part to do with it.
So it sounds like your fascination with the prehistoric world goes way, way back to childhood. What is it about that period of time that appeals to you today as a writer?
Well, I couldn't have predicted it, really, because when at the time of looking to start the first book, Wolf Brother, I thought, well, you know, I just want to write an adventure story. It'll be set in the Stone Age because that's going to be exciting. And then I wanted to make it real. I mean, that the point was I wanted to make the reader, whether they're 10 or 15, really feel that they're having the adventure with Torak and Wren and Wolf. So I thought, well, I better find out what it's like, did some archaeological research, and then the whole thing snowballed from there because I realised that the hunter-gatherer, I just, by accident, really, or because of my childhood, I'd chosen this incredibly interesting time because the hunter-gatherers think differently from us. And, of course, the big one was if you kill an animal, which you have to do, I don't think there were any vegetarians in the Stone Age, if you kill an animal, you've really got to treat it with respect and not waste any part of it because that would be showing disrespect to the powers that rule the forest and then maybe they wouldn't send any more animals and then you die. And so without, you know, wanting to preach a message, these books, nothing are about a message, but in the first book, Wolf Brother, Torak, you know, he's been orphaned by this bear and so he's got to kill his first deer. And take it to bits and use everything. And I know, as a 10-year-old, I would have loved that. It's just fascinating.
Carefully, Torak took aim. The buck raised its head, water dripping from its muzzle. Torak watched it snuff the air and fluff out its pale rump fur in alarm. Another heartbeat and it would be gone. He loosed his arrow. It thudded into the buck's ribs just behind the shoulder. With a graceful shudder, the buck folded its knees and sank to the ground. Torak gave a shout and pushed through the undergrowth towards it. Wolf raced him and easily won, but then pulled back to let Torak catch up. The cub was learning to respect the lead wolf. Panting, Torak stood over the buck. Its ribs were still heaving, but death was near. Its three souls were getting ready to leave. Torak swallowed. Now he had to do what he'd seen Far do countless times, but for him it would be the first time, and he had to get it right. Kneeling beside the buck, he put out his hand and gently stroked its rough, sweaty cheek. The buck lay quiet under his palm. "You did well," Torak told it. His voice sounded awkward. "You were brave and clever, and you kept going all day. I promised to keep the pact with the world spirit and treat you with respect. Now, go in peace."
I think because he had a greater understanding than I do of his surroundings, there's so much that I hope I keep the balance of, you know, him actually loving it, you know, and really enjoying it and having a great time because, after all, he doesn't have to go to school. You know, he has a wolf for a friend and he knows so much because he's just grown up in the forest. You know, a hunter-gatherer knows their surroundings really well. They've got a great sense of direction, usually, which I don't have. That's why I gave a good one to Torak. And he knows about the birds and the animals and the rocks because everything he needs for survival, he's got to find or make from what's just around him. And I think that's what also fascinated me as a child.
Michelle, if you could go back in time, 6,000 years to the time of Torak and his friends, what questions would you have that you would want answered?
Oh, goodness. Oh, gosh, I've never been asked that before. I'm usually asked sort of, would you want to go back in time? Of course, the answer is yes, but for only a short period of time. What would I ask them?
I guess I'm curious about what big mysteries remain about our human ancestors.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, of course, we don't really know what they looked like. Obviously, they looked, you know, in sort of physical terms like you or me, but the very few bodies we found have had tattoos on them. I mean, there was this famous, I think he's sort of been nicknamed Iceman. He's about 5,500 years old. He was found on the sort of border between Italy and Switzerland. He had some tattoos on him, and that gave me the idea for the clan tattoos. I'd love to see how they looked, because I think most of the evidence is that, you know, people take a lot of trouble with their appearances. I don't think they would have been any different. And the other great thing, of course, is their stories. What stories did they tell? I've tried to make up stories for them, really. You know, that Torak's journey from Wolf Brother when he's a young lad of 12 to fighting the Soul Eaters, the forces of evil, all the way through to Ghost Hunter, is really a cycle of six books of him discovering his world. You know, he goes to the sea in the far north and then to the mountains in Ghost Hunter. And I've kind of created, I hope, a sort of legend for the Stone Age people, the hunter-gatherers. But what stories did they tell? Because, of course, for them, the world was old. You know, it stretched back thousands of years and they probably had their own sort of canon of stories. So I think, really, the great mystery for me as a storyteller would be to ask them to tell me some stories. That would be fascinating. Sit around the fire with their greatest storyteller, their clan mage, whoever, and hear them telling their stories.
He longed to howl a reply, to tell Wolf that it was not forever, that one day he would find some way for them to be together. But he couldn't think how to say it, because in wolf talk there is no future. Instead, he said it in his own speech. He knew that Wolf wouldn't understand, but he also knew that he was making the promise to himself as much as to Wolf. "Some day," he called, and his voice rang through the radiant air. "Some day we will be together. We will hunt together in the forest. Together!" His voice broke. "I promise! My brother, the wolf!" No answer came back, but Torak had not expected one. He had made his promise. He stooped for a handful of snow to cool his burning face. It felt good. He scooped up some more and rubbed the death mark from his forehead. Then he turned and started back towards the forest.
Sir Ian McKellen reading from the young adult novel Wolf Brother, which is part of the Chronicles of Ancient Darkness series by Michelle Paver. Paver spoke with Anne Strangehamps. Now, you don't need fiction or paleontology to find out about our human ancestors. Coming up, we'll speak with the 72-year-old leader of the modern caveman movement.
You occasionally pull your Land Rover with a rope?
I do, yes. I pull it up the slope of my driveway. I imagine that pulling a... Yes, yes, of course. I imagine I'm pulling a bison out of a pit.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. If you think cavemen are a thing of the past, think again. The modern caveman movement is upon us. These urban cavemen are in gyms, grunting and sprinting on all fours and lifting heavy stones, replicating how a caveman might flee a mastodon or carry his kill back to the cave. They're running barefoot. They're eating a Paleolithic diet of meat, often raw, with no grains or beans or bread or dairy. Now, who do these modern cavemen look to for leadership? Arthur Devaney, a 72-year-old retired economics professor who performs physical feats of such prowess that even athletes in their 20s are in awe of him. Devaney calls his lifestyle evolutionary fitness, and he told Anne Strangehamps, it's all about mimicking what our cavemen Paleolithic ancestors would have done.
They were foraging broadly over territory. They used their sprinting ability to either capture prey, to kill prey. For example, they ran them into pits and leapt into the pits and killed bison and horses and what have you. or they chased animals, and of course they were chased by animals. So the speed pathway is a very critical and neglected aspect of modern fitness approach, which primarily emphasizes aerobic metabolism, routine, dull activities on a treadmill, steady state sort of thing. The body, you need to disturb homeostasis in the body so that it will adapt.
Have you invented any exercises to try to do what you're talking about?
Well, primarily I emphasize the strength pathway. Sprinting, intermixed with walks. I don't think there's any exercise anyone could possibly invent these days, but I do have a protocol in terms of the way I work out in the gym, because it's absolutely crucial to maintain your muscle mass to stave off aging. I've done that successfully. I still weigh 200 pounds and have for 50-some-odd years.
Even more remarkable, what I've read about you is, what's your ratio of fat to muscle?
Well, 8% body fat.
I can barely even
ridiculous.
Imagine that.
You're
just
it
a
is
big
ridiculous.
Walking pile of muscle and bone, I guess.
Well, maybe, but very active and a very caring, warm person as well. Not a muscle head.
What does your doctor say at your annual checkups?
He says, someday when I grow up, I want to be just like you. And he's 45 years old. He thinks I'm a marvel, but I think it's just the natural way to live. You don't have to age the way people are aging.
Now, I was asking you about your exercise routine. One I've read about that you didn't mention is you occasionally pull your Land Rover with a rope?
I do, yes. I pull it up the slope of my driveway. I imagine that pulling a... Yes, yes, of course. I imagine I'm pulling a bison out of a pit.
A Land Rover weighs what, 5,000-6,000 pounds?
Close to 6,000. It's a big Range Rover that I have. And
you can actually move it.
I can. I can move it quite some distance up the slope of the driveway. And then I let it down, and I try to stop it. I don't put the brakes on. I think there needs to be a little bit of risk in life, too, and I hope it doesn't run into my office.
Do your neighbors all come out and stand around while you do this?
Well, a television show came down to shoot me doing it, and they had me do it 9 or 10 times, and then they had me go out and run in the desert. And by that time, I was a little bit worn down, but then I recovered, and we went to the gym, and I had a workout as well. I never get tired. It's something we can't afford to do. It doesn't have to happen.
Okay,
and
but
it's not...
Now I have to ask, what do you eat to fuel that kind of expenditure of energy?
I eat rather sparingly. I don't know my caloric intake. I never have counted it in all my life, but some days it's probably 5,000 calories. Other days it's nothing. And I do everything in between. There's no ordinary day in terms of eating. Let's see, this morning I had leftover flank steak that I had done on the grill with a bit of cantaloupe, about half a cantaloupe, and maybe about a pound of meat on the flank steak. Remember, flank steak's very lean, so it was a nice meal.
Uh-huh. And what will you have for dinner?
Tonight I think we're planning steaks, although last night we had the flank steak with asparagus and a beautiful salad and fresh artichokes that were steamed. We eat wonderfully, really. We eat abundantly. My wife is a wonderful Italian cook, and she took my originally Paleolithic style of chunky grilled eating and turned it into this wonderful, I call it the Paleolithic Mediterranean cuisine, because it's...
What don't you eat?
I don't eat bread, I don't eat rice, I don't eat potatoes, I don't eat beans, I don't eat milk.
So pretty much you don't eat any of the foods that humans developed after they moved to an agrarian society, is that right?
That would be a fair statement. I do try to mimic, with modern foods, the pattern that would have prevailed during the Paleolithic.
What's so wrong with the agrarian diet?
Well, you can start by looking at the skeletal remains of the first farmers, if you like. Now, some of the problems with the first farmers come from the fact that they were so closely settled together and that sanitation became a problem. So there's an invasion of novel pathogens into the into the human existence that were somewhat rare, in fact, very rare previously because of the low densities hunter-gatherers lived in. But if you look at the skeletons, you'll see a diminishment of the stature, that is, the size of humans diminished quite significantly, maybe 5 inches in males, maybe 6 inches. Brain size diminished. It also shows possible anemia and just a general lack of robusticity and health, and the teeth were poor.
Boy, so we moved to the agrarian diet and just went to hell in a handbasket.
Well, this is what Jared Diamond says in his wonderful essay, "The Worst Invention of Mankind is Agriculture." It wasn't only the reduction in the size of the brain and in the size of the physical size of humans and the way they were worn and torn by the hardships of agriculture, the repetitive toil of agriculture, but it was also the emergence of class structures and of hierarchy, whereas humans had always lived with a more or less flat hierarchy, so to speak. Everybody was sort of everyone else's equal. Once you had agriculture and the control of water and of land, you created the basis for hierarchical societies. Mm. So we have disease, hierarchical societies, diminishment of stature and brain size. By the way, the shrinkage of the brain is continuing even to the modern era. Probably we're not as smart as our Cro-Magnon ancestors.
Arthur Devaney is one of the founders of the modern caveman movement. He's also the creator of the evolutionary fitness model. Anne Strangechance spoke with him. Are you a modern caveman? Do you practice evolutionary fitness? You can send us email at ttbook.org or go to our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. This hour, we've been talking about early humans. For anthropologists and paleontologists, the big question is, when did we actually become human? Harvard anthropologist Richard Wrangham says it's simple. It's when we started cooking. He's the author of Catching Fire, How Cooking Made Us Human. Wrangham told Steve Paulson that without cooking our food, physically we couldn't even survive.
Humans are unable to really survive effectively on raw food. The only condition in which we can do it is in the very unusual situation of urban people with access to very high quality domesticated foods that they can get all year from all the different places that produce them in the right seasons. Under any other conditions, I discovered, somewhat to my surprise, I suppose, that this does not happen. And the thing that led me in this direction was having spent many years studying chimpanzees. And when I was with chimpanzees in the bush, I would sometimes take lunch with me, but sometimes I would not. And in that case, I would be forced to eat what chimpanzees ate all day. And believe me, it was deeply unsatisfying. So this, in a sense, I think, planted the seed in my mind for thinking about what it is that makes humans special with regard to their diets.
So anthropologists have never found a human culture that does not cook its food.
It is correct. Now, you will often find references to cultures that don't cook their foods. So this makes the whole thing rather confusing. But actually, in the middle of the 19th century, within a few years of Darwin producing The Origin of Species and people getting really interested in humans and human adaptation to different environments, there were two or three surveys that went carefully through all that was known and discovered that any stories of people living on raw food in the wild were just that. They were stories, and there was never any evidence of it. But amazingly, even during the 20th century, people continued to come up with such stories. And basically what they are is stories of people that you want to disdain, a way to put people down and say, oh, well, you know, they just eat raw food. But nobody does. Every culture survives on cooked food, and in particular, what is rather interesting, and again, people don't seem to have noticed, although I think it's very important, is that the cooked meal, the big meal of the day, is the evening meal. It's not just that people everywhere cook, but everywhere they have a cooked evening meal.
So why would cooked food have had such a profound effect on our evolutionary history?
Well, this is the amazing thing. Now, if you look in the textbooks, you will see that cooking does all sorts of things. It makes food safer. It kills pathogens and it destroys some of the toxins, some of the poisons. It can preserve food. But amazingly, nobody has really drawn attention before to what appears to be a much bigger biological effect than any of those, which is that it gives us more energy. When we cook, there are various different kinds of processes that go on as a result of heat that lead to food either becoming more digestible or leading to our bodies working less hard to digest the food. And either way, we get an energy gain. And the remarkable thing from the survey of the literature that I conducted is that the energy gains appear to be quite enormous. They're of the order of 30%, 50%, that sort of thing, extra, when you cook your food compared to raw. And it may well be more than that on a regular basis.
So if our ancestors needed a lot less energy once they started cooking food, how did they put that energy, that extra energy, to use?
Well, people have long considered that humans are rather unusual in using a lot of energy. And I think the story is still not fully developed on this. But there were various ways in which our uses of energy changed. One is that we had babies more often compared to the other great apes, chimpanzees, gorillas, orangutans. Humans, for our body size, have babies relatively frequently. They grow at a pretty reasonably slow rate, I mean, somewhat similar to other apes. But because we have them more often, it means that women are using that energy to achieve more reproductively. The distances that people travel are very large compared to the other apes. I mean, a chimpanzee that travels as far as 5 miles in a day is completely shattered the next day and doesn't want to travel at all far, whereas humans regularly travel on an average twice that distance when they're living in a hunting and gathering environment. And then there's this very fascinating area which is concerned with the energetics of the brain. And this is not so much a result of total energy being increased in what we eat as a result of the fact that because we cook our food, we've been able to evolve a smaller gut because we don't need a big gut to deal with all that difficult food. And having a smaller gut saves us energy. And the question is, what do we do with the saved energy? And the answer appears to be that we have diverted it to allow us to grow and maintain a bigger brain. Hmm. So there's lots of different energetic consequences of cooking, both simply getting more energy out of our food and saving us the cost of our guts.
And you're also suggesting, or you also suggest in your book, that there are various anatomical changes that may have resulted from cooked food. You've already mentioned smaller stomachs, but also smaller mouths with weaker jaws. We don't have the same massive jaws that the other primates have.
Yes, I mean, and this is a fascinating area because almost 2 million years ago, you see a greater drop in the size of the teeth in relationship to the size of our bodies than any other time in human evolution. Now, why do teeth become smaller? They don't become smaller in order to be able to cut meat better. You know, what they do to cut meat better is get sharper, and it's often quite large if you look in the lion's mouth. But what the signal of small teeth indicates is soft food. And this is, of course, a very strong clue that these changes that are so important in humans that mean that we are restricted to a diet that includes cooked food probably happened all that time ago, between 1.8 and 1.9 million years ago, when we got this terrific drop in the size of our teeth, coincident, one may say, with evidence that the guts became reduced in size as well. And that evidence is that the ribs become less flared and the pelvis becomes narrower, all consonant with the notion of a less bulky intestinal system.
So is this the date that you were fixing to the invention of cooking, I guess you could say, 1.8 to 1.9 million years ago?
It certainly seems like the most reasonable time based on the fossil evidence as we know it now. And this is striking because people have never known when cooking was invented, but the assumption has always been that it was something in the last few hundred thousand years. So people have always thought, well, that's probably the period within which people first learned to control fire. And that, of course, was a puzzle if you think about it, because there were no anatomical changes in humans at that time. So this hugely significant behavior, putatively, was being adopted without having any impact on our evolutionary anatomy. Well, now you come along and say, now look, cooking has had these tremendous effects. It's given us all sorts of energy. It's softening our food. When do you think the biology of our ancestors fits the acquisition of cooking? And there is only one time, and it's very clear. It's with the evolution of the full genus Homo and the species Homo erectus at exactly 1.8, 1.9 million years ago.
Let's talk about some of the social implications of your theory about how cooking helped make our ancestors human. Presumably, this changed the social dynamics within these groups of people who must have traveled together, that once they started cooking food, I suppose they didn't have to spend as much time going out and finding it.
Well, yes, it changed a lot of things. And one of the great things it changed is the amount of time we spend chewing. This is really extraordinary, but if we were a chimpanzee of our body mass, we would spend something like 5 or 6 hours a day just moving our jaws up and down chewing. But humans spend much less than that. And of course, the reason is because our food is so nice and soft as a result of cooking. So we only spend an hour or less in total chewing time per day. And when you add this together with the resting time after meals, while your guts are working particularly hard, it means that we free up half the day for other activities. So suddenly we can be much more active as hunters or engaged in social activities or all sorts of different things.
Richard Wrangham's the author of Catching Fire, How Cooking Made Us Human. He teaches biological anthropology at Harvard and is the curator of primate behavioral biology at the Peabody Museum. Steve Paulson spoke with him. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Caveman, program number 516A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Charles Monroe Kane, with the help of Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, Anne Strainchamps, and Mary Lou Finnegan. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. Ooga chaka, ooga, ooga, ooga chaka, ooga, ooga, ooga.
Captain Caveman! PRI, Public Radio International.